In the last session, we talked more from a theoretical, philosophical standpoint about musical communication and how to make those choices. In this session, I'd like to look at it from a historical point of view. And we're going to specifically be focusing on hymnody, but I think as you'll see, a lot of what we'll be surveying really has implications for a lot more than just the sacred songs of the church. And I think you'll see that come out in a moment. In the study of my home, I have these three portraits on my wall. Can anybody tell me who these men are? Who's this guy? Martin Luther? Johann Sebastian Bach? Isaac Watts. Very good. Okay. All three of these men are theologian, pastor, musicians, and all three have had impact on the hymnody of the Christian church. But also, all three are commonly compared to modern worship controversies. And usually, these men are used in defense of a contemporary worship philosophy. You'll often hear things like, you'll hear them say, see, people in their day were afraid of new music, and these men who we look up to pushed through the new music, and it's just the same as our day. Have you ever heard an example like that? I was at a workshop once at a Fundamental Baptist conference, and the guy doing the workshop used Watts as an example. He said, here was a young, energetic guy who wanted to write some new songs, and everybody was against him, but he did it anyway, and now we see those songs as the greatest, you know, hymns ever written, and see, it's just like today, and et cetera, et cetera. Or you'll hear things like, Luther used bar tunes, why shouldn't we? Ever heard that one? Okay, we'll talk about that today. Or you'll hear, you know, Bach borrowed from secular music, Watts broke the mold by writing new songs. I've also heard similar arguments like this. The Israelites used the same music as the culture around them. Or the organ was once just as controversial as the electric guitar is today. Or Mozart was a terrible man. How can we say that his music was good? Or Handel's Messiah was popular in his day, just like the pop music in our day. Or didn't Wesley say, why should the devil have all the good tunes? Okay, have you heard some of those arguments before? Okay, these are all assertions based on history, which is good, which is fine, which is what we're going to talk about this afternoon. But they are all assertions, I believe, that are based on ignorance and misunderstanding of the actual facts. And they really just serve to kind of confuse and cloud the discussion even further. So it's for that reason that I think it's important for us to take some time and survey the development of church music through history. And I think we can learn a lot from it. Now, let me set this up a little further. We talked in the last session about musical forms. Okay? Sometimes we call them styles of music, but really the better term is musical forms. Different musical forms that communicate different messages and are therefore more or less appropriate for communicating certain truths. Excuse me. And the reason musical forms are so important is because form shapes the content. We talked about that. You have a musical form that's communicating something, you take a text and put it in there, and it's going to shape that text in a certain way. So I might want to communicate God is, here's the truth. God is majestic and I can trust in Him. But by setting that to a certain poetry and a certain musical form, I can shape that in many different ways. I mean, you may have heard of the great hymn of the faith, God is bigger than the boogeyman. You heard that? What's that communicating? Well, it's communicating God is big and we can trust in Him. But that form, both the poetic form and the musical form, shapes it in such a way to totally trivialize that wonderful truth. Whereas I could take the hymn, A Mighty Fortress is Our God, same basic truth, but that form shapes it in an entirely different way. Am I making sense? Does that make sense? Okay. Which is basically what we talked about in the last session. When we're talking about musical form, here's the second important truth that we need to realize. Not only does musical form communicate and therefore shape the content of the text, But forms are cultivated over long spans of time. In other words, no one gets up one morning and says, you know what, I'm going to invent a new musical style. I'm going to invent a new musical form. It doesn't work that way. Forms are nurtured and cultivated over long periods of time. Art forms are part of what we call culture. Right? And the very term culture illustrates the long-term progressive cultivation of something over time. We get the word culture from this kind of idea, right? Where bacteria is grown in a certain environment and it takes some time. And what grows there does not grow separate from its environment. It's influenced by its environment, right? That's the term culture. It's something that grows and is nurtured and developed over time, influenced by the environment around it. And so when we use the term culture to talk about the art forms around us, we're talking about forms that have been nurtured and developed over time. They are natural products of the environment in which they are nurtured. So cultures are not created in a vacuum. Art forms like music don't just appear somehow by themselves without influence from without. No, they are nurtured and cultivated over time by different values and worldviews and influences working on them to make them what they are. So when we talk about culture, we are talking about expression of value. Some people today view culture as neutral. Culture is just neutral. It's just cultural. You'll hear that kind of argument. But the whole idea of culture is an expression of a value system or multiple value systems. And this means that whatever we create in our time, you know, people write new songs today. Okay? Whatever we create in our time is always built on something that has come before. There's no such thing as inventing a new cultural form just out of nothing. Excuse me. When we write a new song or develop a new cultural form, which happens, we're still nevertheless building on what has come before us. And that has all been influenced by value systems and worldviews and religious views and views about God and views about nature and humanity. And we have to be aware about what those values are. When we create something, if I were to write a hymn today, I am using material that has already been developed and nurtured by people who have come before me. Now, this doesn't mean that cultures cannot or should not change over time. Change is not bad. Cultures do change. Cultures develop. Things that we do today are not the same as even in any of those the days of those three men. But everything that we create starts somewhere within an already existing value system. And we call that tradition. All of us build on a tradition. Anybody who writes a song or produces a musical album or puts a hymnal together, is working from within a tradition. And all I mean by that is we're working with material developed by people that have come before us. We may change it, we may develop it further, we may alter it, but we all work from within a tradition. This is, let me use an example. Try to illustrate what I mean and why this discussion today is so important. If an architect wants to draw up a plan for a home, nobody wakes up one morning and says, without any influences outside him, you know what, I'm gonna draw up a plan for a home. Do they? I mean, it'll probably fall down in about 5 minutes, right? They have to learn how to do it from someone before them. When we build a home, nobody wakes up one morning and says, I'm going to build a home without any help or influence or instructions or models. No. They look at a blueprint, or at least they've looked at the structure of a home so they know what works and what doesn't work. Or if you're gonna bake a cake, nobody without any influence or observation of what a cake is or a recipe wakes up one morning and says, "I'm just gonna throw some things together and make a cake." No, we work with what has come before first, and then maybe after doing it for a while, we may be able to make one without any help. But we always work with what has come before as we develop something new. And this is why it's absolutely essential that we understand how forms have been cultivated through history. And specifically, what we're going to focus our attention on is how the forms of our hymns have been nurtured and cultivated within what I'm going to call the Judeo-Christian tradition. We have, as Christians living in the 21st century, we have at our fingertips a rich heritage of cultural forms that have grown within biblical value systems of first Judaism and then the historic Christian church. Forms that were nurtured and cultivated for the purpose of expressing transcendent biblical truth. And we have such a rich heritage in front of us. And what I'm going to suggest this afternoon is that if we want to truly conserve biblical worship, if we want to be sure that how we are worshiping is consistent with biblical teaching, then we need to look at what has come before us and continue along that same trajectory. Continue in that tradition. We need to avoid novelty for its own sake. You know, there's an inherent virtue today that whatever's new is good. But that's dangerous because we are ignoring hundreds of years of development of various value systems and traditions that have come before us. We need to avoid cultural forms that have been nurtured from within paganism for the purpose of expressing pagan values to pagans. Right? We need to choose forms that have been cultivated within what we might call the community of faith, the historic people of God, for expressing transcendent values, biblical truth, truth, goodness, and beauty. Now, before we even get there, though, I have to first demonstrate to you that such a tradition even exists. You might say, is there even such a thing as a Judeo-Christian tradition in terms of our hymnody? I want to take some decent amount of time here and look at this development of how worship music, specifically the music of congregational singing, has developed throughout history. And I think we can learn some important things that we can apply to our worship, but I think you'll even see even more broadly. The first mention of music in the Bible is in the fourth chapter of Genesis. Verses 17 through 22 list Cain's descendants, and specifically it lists those who have who began the development of various cultural and social skills. So it says that Jabal was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. It says that Tubal-Cain was the forger of instruments of bronze and silver. And then it says that Jubal was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. So we have here some instances of those who began nurturing cultural forms, and we have here a man named Jubal, who was the first to really nurture and cultivate music, instrumental music most specifically. Now, there's an important truth, even as, you know, we're starting at the beginning, we're starting in Genesis, we're going to work all the way through history now. Okay, you ready for this? We'll do it quickly. But the beginning of music gives us a very important revelation, and it is this. Man creates music. Man nurtures cultural forms. Now, it is true that music existed before man did, right? I mean, we even read in Job 38:7 that the morning stars sang together when God created the earth. Many scholars believe those morning stars were very likely angels. who sang when God created the earth. So music certainly existed before people did. And so music in and of itself is something that God created to give as a gift to us. But songs are created by people, not God. Right? God has not given us songs. We write songs. Humans write songs. And ever since the fall of mankind, anything that people create is potentially an expression of sin. You will often hear today, maybe you've heard this, well, how can we say that music can be evil? Music is, God created music, and everything that God creates is good. Ever heard that? I hear that all the time. But they're making a significant category error. Music as an abstract idea was created by God. But people write songs. And so songs can be either good or evil. And in fact, in this chapter, in Genesis chapter 4, just after we read that Jubal was the father of music, we find the first recorded song in Scripture. And this song is not an expression of praise to God. And it's not even a wholesome folk song. It's a song of vengeance by Jubal's father, Lamech. This is his song. Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. The first recorded song in Scripture is a song of vengeance and sin and anger. This only goes to demonstrate why we need to evaluate music. We need to evaluate music because music is human expression, and therefore it could be expression of good or evil. Humans write songs. Now, we can't consider the development of the church's hymnody without first considering the music of the Old Testament Hebrews. Christianity, of course, began as an offshoot of faithful Judaism, right? Of course, with Christ coming and revealing himself. And so, especially in the worship forms of the early church, as we'll sing in a moment, it really was just a natural extension of how Jews worshiped. So if we want to see how the development of Christian hymnody and the worship of the Christian church, it's only natural to look at Israel first, because we inherited our tradition in many ways, obviously adding truth about Christ and his revelation. We inherited a tradition from faithful Hebrew worship. Now, when we're talking about the worship of the Hebrews, Old Testament Hebrews, we need to be very careful not to transplant our perception of Hebrew music today and simply assume that David's music sounded exactly the same. That's natural for us, right? Well, what did David's music sound like? What immediately comes to our mind is what we think of as Hebrew music today. But we've got to be careful not to do that. Why? Well, number one, Jewish music today is really a complex mix of a lot of different influences. Because remember, the Jews were scattered all over the world until the early 1900s. And so you've got a lot of different Western influences, Arabic traditions, and probably some traditional folk influences that has made Jewish music what it is today. You know, you think of kind of rhythmic, okay? That is a lot different from what music was like in the Old Testament, because Jews were scattered all over the world. They were influenced by all kinds of different cultures, and a lot of what we think of when we think of Jewish music today is probably also been filtered through pop culture and Hollywood too. Okay, so when I'm talking here about the Old Testament Hebrew hymns, don't immediately think, oh, that must sound like what we think of when we think of Jewish music today. Well, what did it sound like then? Well, one more important factor to remember. We need to remember that Israel was a theocracy, meaning that their religion, their politics, their social life were all very much intertwined. There was no separation of church and state like we have today, right? It was all one connected thing. And this is important because we need to realize that not all of the music recorded for us in the Old Testament was intended necessarily for corporate worship. Just because a song in the Old Testament talks about God doesn't mean that it was intended for worship. All of their songs talked about God. Their war songs talked about God. Their work songs, their love songs, their folk songs. All of it talked about God because everything was intertwined with God. And so even in the book of Psalms, we have all kinds of different kinds of songs. Did you realize not all of the Psalms were intended for corporate worship? We have work songs, war songs, love songs, songs for entertainment, songs of derision, mourning, lamentation, all kinds of different songs, probably all of which talk about God because they were theocracy, but not all of which necessarily were intended for corporate worship. So when we're evaluating the Old Testament Hebrew hymns during this session, we're narrowing to only those songs that were specifically intended for the corporate worship of God's people in the Old Testament. Now, contrary to popular opinion, we do have a fairly accurate idea of what Hebrew hymns would have sounded like. There has been a lot of research that I won't get into. Don't have time to do it this afternoon. But research into the actual biblical text and some symbols that were embedded into the Hebrew letters themselves. Some research into various tribes that had split off from Israel and gone off on their own and were pretty uninfluenced by other cultures and looking what their music looks like. A lot of different research has gone into scholars being able to reproduce in a pretty accurate manner what the tunes of Hebrew worship very likely would have sounded like. I want to show you an example of this. This is Psalm 113, and this is a 20th century scholar's representation in our musical language. You wouldn't have seen this kind of musical notation at all, obviously, in Old Testament Hebrew life. But this is based on the research of the symbols that have been found and some studies into the groups that have come out of Israel. This is a fairly accurate, they believe, representation of the tune that was very likely sung with Psalm 113. I want to play a little bit of it for you. So it sounds like maybe what you would expect, right? But different than what we think of as modern Jewish music. Because there has been changes based on influences of Western civilization over the years that has made Jewish music what it is today. And I want you to notice a couple things about their music. This is just one example. But I want you to notice some characteristics of their music that we get not only from looking at the texts in the Psalms, also by looking at the instruments which we'll use, which we'll look at in a moment, and then also this extra research into the tunes themselves. There are a couple characteristics that we can notice. First, I think I have this up here. First, Hebrew hymns were text-driven. Now, how do we know that? Well, a couple reasons. Number one, the texts that we have in the Book of Psalms, obviously already we can see, are rich in their doctrine. That was certainly a focus. Okay, but number two, as you could hear in that melody, and as we can see in some examples in the Scripture and in some of the research that's been done, the melodies very closely followed the natural flow, rise and fall of the words. We look at the melodies themselves, the kind of instruments that were used, we can see that they were very much text-driven. The text was very much important to the Hebrews. But second, Hebrew hymns were also, and the word I'll use here is modest. Their melodies are simple, were simple and constrained. And even the instruments they used were of modest character, especially during vocal music. And this runs a little bit to the contrary to popular opinion too. If you look at the scriptures and the descriptions and commandments about their worship, you'll notice that while louder instruments like trumpets were used to signal various events in Hebrew culture, when they sang, they were only accompanied by softer instruments like strings. Their singing was always modest. They used for announcements for going into war or some kind of political celebration, they used loud instruments. But when it came to their corporate singing in the temple, they only used strings. Why? So that it wouldn't cover up the words. Even their percussion was modest. You often hear, well, come on, Hebrew society was very percussive, right? And certainly modern Israel, their music is very percussive. But let's look at the facts. Let's look at the scripture themselves. Here are some facts. Number one, only one pair of cymbals was permitted. And it was very likely small hand cymbals or even finger cymbals. These weren't the big clashing cymbals. Now, it's very easy for us to take our modern, orchestra and, well, the trumpets must have been the same, and the strings must have been the same, and the percussion must have been the same. Well, that's not true. They only allowed one pair of cymbals, and these cymbals were very likely, they weren't used to beat out rhythm. And we know that because there was no steady rhythm in Hebrew culture like there is today. You can see that just in the poetry, right? Have you ever read a psalm and thought, well, that doesn't have a steady rhythm like our poetry today? Well, that's because their art, their poetry and music was not based on a steady rhythm. As you heard a moment ago, that wasn't boom, 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 like we hear today with a steady beat. It wouldn't have been possible back then. Rather, their cymbals were probably more likely used to conduct. So they would be used to signify the beginning of a section of the music or when the singers were supposed to start singing. They were used similar to like a conductor's baton that we have today in our orchestras. Their cymbals were used, except for instead of visual, they were oral. And so even in their percussion, and that was the only percussion that was allowed during worship, even in their percussion, it was very modest. Today's, like I said, today's use of percussion is used to measure out a steady beat. In those days, that wouldn't have been possible with the way their music was. Even their singing was modest, contrary to popular belief. You know, some people say, well, Jewish music was so loud and raucous. Well, it might be today, but that's a difference if you look at what the scripture says about their music. Many people have assumed that Hebrew music was loud and raucous. Why? Well, because other Middle Eastern music during that time was loud and raucous. But that leads us to our third observation. Not only was their music text-driven and modest, but their hymns were distinct from the pagan music that was around them. And the first two features that we've already seen, that it was text-driven and that it was modest, shows us this stark contrast between the pagan music of the day and the Hebrew music. I want to give you one quote here. This is a really fascinating book by Calvin Stapert. He looks at some of this research at the biblical text itself and then correlates it with some of the research that's been done into these cultures. And he says this, Jewish psalmody was word-oriented, which is what we've talked about, a characteristic that set it apart from the music of the sacrificial rites of the Israelites' pagan neighbors. Their music was not word-oriented. Pagan sacrificial music typically featured the frenzy-inducing sound of the loud double reed instruments and the rhythms of orgiastic dancing. Words were superfluous, unimportant. Temple music was different from pagan music in all three respects. Words were primary, and they governed the rhythms. You didn't have a steady beat. The rhythm was based on the rhythm of the words, the natural rhythm of the words. Instrumental accompaniment was by stringed instruments that supported the monophonic vocal line, meaning just a melody, perhaps with some heterophonic embellishments, meaning some harmony, but mostly it was just melodic, but never covering or distracting attention away from the words. Instruments were used independently only for signaling purposes, which I talked about a moment ago, as when trumpets or cymbals signified the beginning of the psalm and the places at the ends of the sections where worshipers should prostrate themselves. And so Hebrew worship, the music that was used, was very clearly distinct from the pagan worship around it. I want to play for you an example of Egyptian music from this same time period that we're talking about. We have scraps of music from Egypt from this very time. And I want you to notice, we just a moment ago listened to what very likely was an example of the singing of the Hebrews. I want you to notice how different that was from this example, which very likely was an example of what Egyptian music would have sounded like. This is derived from actual some scraps of music that were found from the same time period. You notice the difference? It's more driving, more, as the author said here, it kind of works itself into a frenzy. Much different than the Hebrew music of the day. All right, enough of that. But it gets faster and faster and louder and louder. And it was rooted in the pagan worship of the day, all intended to work themselves up into some kind of mystical trance for their worship. Completely distinct from the worship of the Hebrews. Now, in Hebrew culture, the cultural forms that were nurtured for worship would have influenced the other musical forms of their culture as well. We can observe that from the fact that if you look at the book of Psalms, the poetic forms for the songs that were intended for corporate worship are not much different, although there are some differences, but are not much different from their work songs or their war songs or their political songs or their songs for social events. Their cultural form, there was not, in other words, a big distinction between the musical forms intended for worship and the musical forms intended for other aspects of life. They were very similar. Why? Well, because their primary focus was on their worship forms. And those trickled down and influenced the other musical forms as well. Now, when Israel was taken captive in 586 BC, the cultivation of those forms pretty much stopped because they didn't have the freedoms that they once did. But they still remained distinct from their pagan culture. They kept their own culture. They didn't cultivate it anymore. They didn't nurture it anymore. But they kept their Hebrew culture distinct from the culture that was around them. Now, if we look at this period in the history of God's people, we, of course, enjoy singing many of their texts today. And even, although you might not realize it, for instance, hymns by Isaac Watts are paraphrases of various psalms. And so even some of the hymns that we sing are paraphrases of hymns that come from this time period. For instance, O God, our help in ages past is a paraphrase of Psalm 90. Jesus Shall Reign is a paraphrase of Psalm 72. Even a hymn like Joy to the World is a paraphrase of Psalm 98, which, interestingly, is not about Christ's first coming. It's about Christ's second coming. But those are all psalm paraphrases that we sing today. All right, let's go to the next step then and talk about. So here we have an example of kind of the influences of Hebrew culture. They had their religious music, what was specifically nurtured and developed for their worship, which then influenced the high culture of Israel. The art music of Israel. Even if it was not specifically intended for corporate worship, it still was very similar because, as I said, Israel was a theocracy, so it was all very similar. And that influenced their folk culture, their folk dancing, which was probably very similar to like a square dance in our day. It was just a social event, but very similar in form to their worship music, because it was all a top-down kind of thing. They nurtured the forms to express transcendent values about God, and then it trickled down and influenced the other cultural elements of their society. And then, as I said, they were always careful to be distinct from pagan culture because God had commanded them, be holy as God is holy. Now, that didn't always work. Of course, we look at Israel, and there was times when they went back into syncretism, and there was all of those problems for sure. But when they were at their best, they maintained this kind of distinction. We move then to the early church. The hymnody of the early church, after Pentecost, after the church was established, people believed in Jesus Christ as their Messiah and His atonement for their sins. The hymnody of the early church was a natural extension of Hebrew hymnody. And therefore, we can expect the hymnody of the early church to have the same general characteristics. Word-driven, modest, and distinct from pagan culture. And they continued to nurture these forms, and then, of course, very quickly began to add truth about Jesus Christ. They continued singing the Psalms, but they also began to write their own hymns about Jesus Christ and His sacrificial atonement on the cross. And in fact, we have some of those hymns recorded for us in the New Testament, like the beginning of Ephesians, the first 11 verses. It's very likely a hymn sung by the early church. Philippians chapter 2. There are several portions in the New Testament that are written in Greek poetic form that very likely were the hymns of the earliest hymns of the church. As the church began to spread, churches continued to nurture these forms. They're working within a tradition, taking what has been given to them from the past, and then working to nurture, and it changed and developed over time, certainly, but they're still working from within this tradition. And all three of the characteristics that we saw in Hebrew hymns are also very characteristic of the hymns of the early church. First, early church hymns were text-driven. Church leaders, if you look at their writings, continued to praise the use of psalms in corporate worship. And the new texts that they wrote were filled with robust doctrinal truth. Let me just give you one example. Here's an example of a hymn, one of the earliest hymns that we have, written by Ignatius of Antioch. Very flesh, yet spirit too, uncreated and yet born. Of course, this is a translation. He wrote it in Greek, I think. God and man in one agreed, very life and death indeed, fruit of God and Mary's seed, at once impassable and torn by pain and suffering here below, Jesus Christ, whom as our Lord we know. Rich truths about Jesus Christ and His humanity and His deity, His virgin birth. These early hymns written by some of the earliest church leaders, very much text-driven. Their musical forms were just naturally borrowed from the Hebrew forms that had come before them. And they continued that tradition of using melodies that followed the natural rise and fall of the human voice. We know that today as plain chant or later Gregorian chant. Very similar in many ways to the Hebrew chanting and singing that had come before them. And in fact, scholars have noticed that some of the earliest Gregorian chants resemble the melodies that they have discovered from the Hebrews. They just took those same melodies and they continued singing them. And of course, over time, they were nurtured and developed and changed, but they continued that tradition. Second, early church hymns, just like the Hebrew hymns, were modest. If you read these early church leaders, they are unanimous in their warning against what they called extravagant music. For instance, consider this statement by Clement of Alexandria. He said this, "But we must abominate extravagant music, which enervates men's souls and leads to changefulness, now mournful, then licentious, then voluptuous, and then frenzied, and then frantic." He was against music that was just extravagant and bombastic. Rather, Clement and others, this is just one example, argued that the church's hymnody should employ what he called temperate harmonies. This emphasis of having modest music was in contrast to the culture in which the early church lived, the Greek and then Roman culture. And in this way, just like with Hebrew hymns, early church hymns were very much distinct from the pagan culture around them. I want to give you another quote from from Stapert, who talks about the music of this early Greek and Roman culture. He said most of them featured ecstatic, even frenzied and orgiastic rites. Ecstatic rituals were not uncommon in Greek and Roman societies, going back centuries before the Christian era. The rituals associated with the worship of Dionysius, or his Roman equivalent Bacchus, are the classic example of this type. Drunken revelry, wild music, frenzied dancing, and flagellation and mutilation were their hallmarks. This is what the pagan worship was like. It was wild, it was frenzied. And you read these early church leaders, and they're advocating modest and temperate. I want to give you an example of early Greek music. You probably have in your mind, I don't have to play an example for you, I think I will in a moment actually, but Gregorian chant, the kind of music that the early church sung, very similar to what the Hebrews sung, modest, just natural rise and fall of the human voice. Listen to how distinct that is from this. This is an actual example, obviously recorded recently, but an actual example of early Greek worship music. Sounds very similar to the Egyptian music, actually. Even the sounds of the instruments kind of have a seedy, eerie feel to them, don't they? And again, this is another example. If we listen to the whole thing, it just works faster and faster and becomes more driving and driving. And the whole point was to work the worshipers into a frenzy of supposed worship. But again, the early church, very careful to separate themselves from the pagan worship of their culture, just like the Hebrew fathers before them. And in fact, they were so much against the pagan worship that these early church fathers even got rid of all instrumental music whatsoever. Let me show you an example of this. Here's Clement of Alexandria again. He said, "When a man occupies his time with flutes, stringed instruments, choirs, dancing, Egyptian crotala, and other such improper frivolities, he will find that indecency and rudeness are the consequence." You'll find writings like this all the time, condemning the instruments that were used in the pagan worship of the day. And they did so, they rejected the instruments for two reasons. Number one, they didn't want to associate themselves with the pagan cultural practices. So they just got rid of instruments altogether, which I would say was probably, they probably went too far, but I understand why they did it in their culture. But second, I want you to notice they thought that the particular instruments that were used, like we just heard, sounded in such a way that really shaped the content in ways that they didn't want it to sound like. We have to remember, when he talks about flutes and instruments like that, it's not the same as our flutes today. These were different instruments. That reedy sounding, kind of eerie instrument that you heard would have been what they called a flute. It was probably more of a double reed kind of instrument. And so they wanted to stay away from that because they didn't want to be associated with pagan culture. And also they thought that those instruments actually shaped the content in such a way that was not fitting with Christian worship. So let's move maybe next to the hymns of the medieval church. When Emperor Constantine legalized Christianity in 313, the cultural conditions of the church, and when I say church, of course, at this period in history, we have a mixed bag. We have some people who are beginning to develop some heresy that later developed into the Roman Catholic Church. We also have some people during this time who are true believers and are trying to be orthodox in their Christianity. It's very difficult when you look at what we call the church during this medieval time. It's very difficult to know who is truly a believer and who's not, because a lot of the way that we articulate doctrine today hadn't quite been worked out. Nevertheless, the cultural development during this time was very similar to what the Hebrews enjoyed during their golden age. Because what happened was when Constantine legalized Christianity, over time, they eventually stamped out any explicit pagan influence, and the church really ruled. Now, again, there was a lot of problems during this time, theologically, in many ways. They were still working out, okay, how best should we articulate the doctrine of the deity of Christ? How best should we articulate all of these particular doctrines? But nevertheless, they did stamp out paganism, and the church continued this development of their worship music that followed in this trajectory of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And therefore, the characteristics of hymns written during this time are exactly the same as what we've been seeing. First of all, they're text-driven. Hebrew plain chant moved into what we call first Ambrosian chant and then Gregorian chant. And again, it's becoming a little bit more complex. It's becoming a little more developed because over time they nurture these forms. But still, it gives attention to the natural rise and fall of these doctrinally rich texts. And during this time, new hymn texts were being written a lot to combat heresy. One of the best examples of this are hymns that were written to combat the denial of the deity of Christ, which was rising during this time. For instance, here's a hymn by Ambrose of Milan, who is called the father of Christian hymnody. He's really the one who really nurtured writing a lot of good hymn texts. This is a wonderful Christological hymn. O splendor of God's glory bright, who bringest forth a light from light, light of light, light's fountain spring, O day, our day's enlightening. We sing this hymn in our church, a wonderful Christological text. He wrote this to combat those who were teaching that Christ was not truly God. And so we have a lot of these word-driven, text-driven, doctrinally rich hymns being written during this time. Secondly, hymns during the medieval period were modest. Again, church leaders were against what they called passionate music. They were against it. Here's an example, again, from Stapert. He says, many musical references during this time, deal with passion. For instance, Isidore of Pelusium warned against misusing music to arouse passion. And Basil warned against being brought down to the passions of the flesh by the pleasure of song. Such statements sound very strange in a culture such as ours, which places such a high premium on passion, which values intense emotion and the music that stimulates it, and which prizes excitement and the music that provides a high or a rush, right? I mean, we hear them talking against passionate music, and in our culture, that's what music is all about. It's about giving us this excited feeling and this high. But in their day, they warned against that. They didn't want us to be distracted from being moved by the truth of the text. These church leaders weren't against expression of affection toward God, certainly. In fact, here's an example from Augustine, who said this: sing to him in jubilation. This is what acceptable singing to God means, to sing jubilantly. But what is that? It is to grasp the fact that what is sung in the heart cannot be articulated with words. To whom then is this jubilation more fittingly offered than God who surpasses all utterance? You cannot speak of him because he transcends our speech, but if you cannot speak of him, yet may not remain silent, what else can you do but to cry out in jubilation so that your heart may tell its joy without words and the unbounded rush of gladness not be cramped by syllables. Sing skillfully to him in jubilation. So they weren't against music expressing our hearts to the Lord, but they were against music that merely was intended to arouse the passions. They were not against music that expressed our hearts, but they were against music that somehow manipulated us to feel a certain way or to be roused in a certain way. And then third, once again, medieval hymns were distinct from the pagan culture around them. Again, just like their fathers before them, medieval church leaders spoke out against the pagan music of their day. I'll just give you one example from John Chrysostom. He said, what can one say of the songs themselves, crammed as they are with all uncleanness, introducing monstrous amours and unlawful connections and subversions of houses and tragic scenes without end? And what is still more grievous, that young women are are present at these things, and in the midst of wanton young men act a shameless part with their disorderly songs, with their foul words, and with their devilish harmony. Tell me, do you still inquire whence come adulterers, whence fornications, whence violation of marriages? It's because of all the music that's all around us. So they were very strong in their condemnation of the pagan music that did exist around them. And notice again, the argument against pagan music was more than just associations, although it did include that. But the argument was based in the fact that the music itself communicated evil messages. So the music during this time, the hymns that were sung by the church that were nurtured, were in the same way, modest, text-driven, and distinct from culture. So here's another example of the kind of influences that were going on during this time. Very similar to the golden age of the Hebrews. The musical, and this is important for what we're going to talk about in a moment, but the musical forms of the day were nurtured in the church. That's where all the composers were. That's where all the music writers were. They were writing for the church. They weren't all necessarily Christians based on how much heresy had developed during what time, but their purpose was to write music that expressed transcendent truth about God. That's where the music was nurtured. And then those musical forms filtered down into the high culture of the day and then into the folk culture of the day. So the art music that wasn't necessarily sacred and the common folk music of the people. The tunes that were sung in the marketplace, in the home, in the social event, were developed in the church and then used in the marketplace. Very important, as we'll see in a moment. And as I said, for all practical purposes, there wasn't really a whole lot of pagan culture over time in Western civilization because the church gained so much of a dominant influence, which, of course, turned out to be something bad in the development of the Roman Catholic Church, but in terms of the culture, was a relatively good thing. There are many hymn texts and tunes that we sing today that are from this period. For example, do you know the hymn "Of the Father's Love Begotten"? Wonderful. We sing it at Christmas a lot. I think I have an example of it here. This is a Gregorian chant. And we even sing it today with some, we've altered it a bit and usually add some harmony. But this is probably the earliest hymn that is still in common use today. That's a wonderful hymn about Christ's incarnation, his virgin birth, his deity, his humanity. The text is from the 5th century, and the tune is from about the 11th century. All glory, laud, and honor. Do you know that hymn? Is a text that was written around 820. All creatures of our God and King, written by Francis of Assisi in 1225. Be Thou My Vision is an Irish hymn from around the 8th century. O Sacred Head, Thou Wounded was written by Bernard de Clairvaux in 1153. The tune that we sing to When I Survey the Wondrous Cross is taken from a Gregorian chant. That's another one of the oldest tunes. The text, of course, is by Isaac Watts. It's a much newer text, but the tune, Lowell Mason, who was an American composer, took a Gregorian chant and adapted it and changed it a little bit. But it's basically based on tunes and music that was developed during this time of the church. All right, let's move to the time of the Reformation. When Martin Luther sparked the Reformation of the church, he challenged the Roman church's doctrine and he challenged their practice. But he never challenged their musical forms because he suggested what they had developed musically expressed transcendent values that were still compatible with his recovery of evangelical truth, doctrine of justification, etc. And so the musical forms of the Reformation continued to follow in the Judeo-Christian tradition. We still have this almost unbroken stream with all of its bumps and problems along the way, because I don't want to paint a perfect picture. It certainly was written with problems. But we still have taking what has come before and nurturing it and cultivating it and developing it further into the new forms. The most significant change that Luther made was to insist that the singing be put in the language of the people. So he changed the doctrine of what was being sung, and he changed the language of what was being sung, but he still kept the same musical forms that had been sung for years and years and nurtured over time. And this, of course, led Luther to write wonderful text-driven hymns, like A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, many, many hymns written during this time that are so rich with theological truth. Of course, in a lot of cases, emphasizing some of the new truths that were being recovered, such as justification by faith and sola scriptura and sola fide and those sorts of doctrines. But even the tune that Luther wrote, he wrote a couple tunes, not very many, but he wrote the tune to A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, it is taken from a Gregorian tune, and he adapted it for his hymn. And so you can see he's still looking back, saying, "Okay, that's good. I have to take from somewhere. We all have to use material that's come before us from someplace. So where are we going to get it? Well, we're going to get it from the tradition that is most faithfully preserved." The communication of transcendent biblical truth. So the first characteristic, once again, text-driven. Also, the hymns of the Reformation period were modest. Those who wrote hymn tunes wanted their tunes to be ordered and refined. Here, for example, is a composer during this time who said this: "Equality of measure is indeed to be preserved, lest the harmony be impaired or confused. For to sing without rule and measure is to offend God Himself, who arranged all things by number, weight, and measure." So you'll see men who wrote during this time talking about music being modest and refined and carefully composed so as to rightly communicate messages that fit with God's truth. John Calvin especially insisted that hymns be modest in their character. Calvin was a musician, and he understood the power of music to stir the passions. And so he went even so far as to prohibit the use of instruments. Not because he saw anything inherently wrong with them himself. He said you can use instruments outside the church. But he was so worried, he so wanted to guard against immoderate music that would manipulate people. He so wanted to guard against that he banned the use of instruments in corporate worship altogether. He also insisted on the singing of metrical psalmody only singing the psalms in their churches. But again, this had nothing to do with musical form. They still continued to use the same musical forms. He was just trying to recover, to fight against the Roman church and all of their aberrant doctrine. And so he said, let's just stick with the text of Scripture to make sure that we can recover some of those doctrines. And many churches that follow in that tradition still have a rich heritage of psalmody. And just like in previous times, Well, let's look at this first. This basically was still the same culture during the Reformation, and this brings up a good point. Okay, we talked about this. The music was nurtured here and then filtered down into the high culture and folk culture. So what was sung in terms of art music was musical forms that was nurtured in the church. What was sung in the marketplace were musical forms. Even what was sung in the taverns was musical forms. The texts, of course, probably were raunchy, but the music, all the composers were up here. This is why you often hear, well, Luther used bar tunes. Why can't we? Okay, let's deal with that statement here for a moment. There's a problem with that statement on two points. Number one, let's deal with this one first. Even if he did, and he did in one case, you always hear, oh, they always used bar tunes. No, he did it once. And even so, remember that the tunes were nurtured up here. These weren't pagans nurturing and developing pagan music to express pagan values. These were Christians nurturing and developing music to communicate weighty matters, and then those kinds of tunes eventually made them way down into the secular music of the day. For instance, one author says, even the love song of Luther's time was a serious and weighty affair. Okay? But, even so, okay, that's one thing. And even when Luther did it one time he took a tune that was sung, it was a love song. And he took that tune and he took a text that he wrote and he put them together because he thought the music is communicating something that's fitting with my text. But even then, he realized that the conventional association was so strong with the secular love song that eventually he got rid of it because he was so embarrassed. So if you ever hear people say, Luther used secular music. Well, number one, he did one time, but it was because it had been developed in the church first. And even then, very quickly he got rid of it because the conventional association was so strong. But there's even another problem with the statement that says Luther used bar tunes. Yes, Luther used bar tunes. He did, a lot. But bar tunes does not mean tunes that were sung in a bar. Bar form is a musical form. It's a musical form of A-A-B. In other words, we have a certain musical phrase, and then we repeat it, A-A, and then we have a contrasting phrase. So, for example, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. Bum, 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 ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, dun, 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 ba-da-dum, bum. Repeat it. Bum, 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 ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, bum, 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 ba-da-dum, bum, ba-da-da-da-da-da, and then we have the rest. You see how that's A-A-B? Musicians call that bar form. And Luther and others wrote in that form a lot. They did. They wrote in bar form. People hear bar and they say, ooh, Luther used bar music, so why can't we? Well, it has nothing to do with music that was sung in a tavern. It has to do with a legitimate musical form, a phrase, repeat the phrase, different phrase, that was nurtured within the church to communicate biblical transcendent values. And Luther used that. So there's a, you can fight against that claim, all right? Luther was careful to avoid what he called carnal music. He was very much distinct. Oh, there's the AAB. Very much distinct from secular culture. So even in the folk culture, like I said, he's still worried about the associations that might cause people to stumble, etc. The English hymn writers, the great English hymn writers, Isaac Watts, Charles Wesley, they also loosely fall into this period of the Judeo-Christian tradition as well. And Watts is often, he's called the father of English hymnody. He's often cited, as I mentioned earlier, as a great innovator who went against the common conservative position of the day and changed things. Well, he did change some things. In England during that time, during the time that Watts lived, most of the churches limited their singing only to metrical psalms. And Watts insisted, no, we should also be able to sing hymns that we write, new hymns that we write. But was that anything new? That was not new. Christians had been writing hymns for years, for centuries, right? It just happened new in England because of traditions that had crept up in that land. So Watts was no great innovator. He just wrote some great hymns that followed in the tradition of the people of God, the Jews and then the church. Most of the hymns that we sing in our church today come from this great period of hymn writing. No other period in the history of the church has produced such a wealth of word-driven, modest, distinct hymnody, both in text and tunes. We have such a wonderful, rich heritage. Luther and Gerhardt and Kruger and Tiersteegen and all of these men, Watts and Wesley, wrote some wonderful, wonderful hymns that we still enjoy singing today. All right, we're nearing the end of our journey. Okay, I like pictures. This is important for us to get because of what's going to happen next. So I want to spend some time here. Okay? We have here four streams of culture. The Judeo-Christian tradition, which we've been talking about, which is the music that was used first in Israel and then in the church throughout history. high culture, meaning the art music of the civilization. Not necessarily intended for worship, not necessarily even sacred, but it's the high art music. Folk culture, which is the music of the people, the music sung in the marketplace, the music sung in the homes, usually not written down, usually just oral, and then the music and the pagan culture. Okay? During the golden age of Israel, we had musical forms being nurtured here and then filtering down into the art music and the folk music of the day. And they were distinct from paganism. Here we have the Hebrew exile, and during this time, we still have a distinction from paganism, but there's not a lot of nurturing and cultivation going on because they were in exile. And this really continued all the way through the early church until Constantine legalized Christianity. Once that happened, eventually we have, once again, musical forms being nurtured in the church, filtering down into the art music of the day, filtering down into the folk music of the day, and in a lot of ways, there really wasn't a whole lot of pagan, direct pagan influence during that time because of the dominance of Christianity with all its warts, and obviously it developed into something horrible. But remember, the Roman Church as it is today, which is entirely heretical, didn't get to exactly, or didn't wasn't confirmed in what it teaches today until the Council of Trent. Years later. Before that, you have a lot of mixed bag until then. All right. Let's talk about the Enlightenment. Thus far, in our journey, we've seen an almost unbroken stream of a Judeo-Christian tradition within first Israel and then the church. A lot of warts, a lot of problems, certainly errors, fallible human beings, but generally speaking, following in this desire to express transcendent biblical truth, to cultivate these worship forms for the worship of God, the praise of God, and the expression of biblical truth. However, in the 18th century, something changed that would forever alter this path. In many ways, we could say that the people of God were once again exiled, only this time they didn't realize it. What do I mean? Well, the 18th century brought about what has come to be called the Enlightenment, or the Age of Reason. And what happened was reason and science, over time, were elevated over faith. And in the words of Abraham Kuyper, this was the expulsion of God from practical and theoretical life. What the Age of Reason did was to expel God. We don't trust faith anymore. Science and the reason of man is king. And so the position that the church had enjoyed as the dominant cultural influence was no longer the case. Reason took over. People distrusted religion. People distrusted faith. Anything that couldn't be proven with reason and science was not believed. And what happened was, what this meant for worship forms was that active cultivation of musical forms in the church virtually stopped. The church, of course, still had all of the hymns that had been nurtured for thousands of years before, but all of the talented poets, musicians, stopped for the church and began writing for their own purposes. They continued writing noble music for a while because they had to use what had been handed to them. But pretty soon, high culture broke off, had no religious moorings whatsoever, and eventually it all but died away. I mean, how much high culture is really being nurtured today? How much art music? And you look at the music of Bach and Haydn and Mozart, and this is during the time when it's losing its religious moorings. How much great, noble, majestic music was written during that time, and how much is written today? Well, why is not much being written today? It's because high culture once was connected to religion, once was connected to transcendent values about God, now with the Age of Reason, broke off and had no connection with any absolute truth, goodness, or beauty at all. Here are some of the values of the Enlightenment. Reason over faith. Oh, we talked about that already. Oh, here's a picture of what happened. Okay. So here we have our diagram again. Here's the Enlightenment. So what happens now is people are not trusting religion anymore. So you see this distinction. High culture continues for a while with men like Haydn and Mozart and Handel and even Beethoven. But pretty soon, because the last great composer who has any real faith in Jesus Christ is Johann Sebastian Bach. There are others, but he's probably the most well-known. But then Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, these men, and pretty soon there's no desire to express transcendent values, so what's the point? Folk culture dies. Why? We'll talk about that in a minute. And for the first time, you see pagan culture beginning to really strongly influence the other forms of culture. Won't spend a lot of time here, but instead of music being designed to communicate biblical values about God, over time, with the age of reason, this became the goal of music, to excite human passion. Music provides entertainment rather than shaping of content. The best music is characterized by constant variety, that newness that we're always looking for. Individualism and originality are virtues rather than cultivating a noble tradition. The gauge of music's popular music excellence is popular acclaim. Is that excellent music? Well, how popular is it? Instead of, it's excellent because it shapes content in an appropriate manner. The best kind of music is natural and unlearned. There is a noble savage kind of idea. Music is purely scientific without any ethical dimension. This is where you start to develop the idea that music is morally neutral. And music is unimportant rather than that which orders men's souls. This is a strong quote by a man named Quentin Faulkner in a great book about this. He says, music, for all that matter, all the arts, had become a theological orphan. Prior to this, the cultivation of music was tied with biblical Christianity. Now, with the age of reason, music springs off on its own. Music had become a theological orphan. In fact, he says, no important theological movement, either in the 19th or 20th century, has concerned itself with in any profound way with the significance of harmony, order, or beauty in Christian life or worship. This was a significant change in the development of culture, of worship, etc. So this is where now you get mass media, you get savvy businessmen saying, hey, how can we make a quick buck? And music becomes something that's used for entertainment, something that's used to make money. This is what created what we call pop culture. Pop culture did not exist prior to the age of reason and the invention of mass media and those sorts of things. Pop culture is essentially a sanitized version of paganism. And it has come to rule the day. Let's go one step further. Okay, so here we have paganism, and it's kind of sanitized through pop culture, but we have this new stream. This kind of culture had never existed before. It is a commercial culture designed to make money, and it permeated the world. That's why folk culture basically dies away, because folk culture is killed when pop culture invades a civilization. And so you have what is now called pop culture. Okay, get there in a moment. Now, this left the church, Christians, in a very awkward position. What are we going to do? Its cultural influence is now non-existent. Prior to this time, I mean, during the Middle Ages and the Reformation, boy, the church is where the music was cultivated. But now, they've lost their position. And as the culture around it began to plunge into paganism, you know, for a while the church maintained the rich hymns that had been sung for thousands of years, but they're becoming more and more irrelevant. Right? I mean, if I'm maintaining this standard and the world around me is going like this, it's getting further and further away. The church is no longer influencing the high and folk culture of the civilization. It's now just out there on its own, and everything else is going down the tubes. So what are we to do? Do we continue to cultivate the Judeo-Christian tradition and become more and more alienated from our surrounding culture? Or do we contextualize, which is the hot phrase, and follow the lead of pop culture? And as you know, the church ultimately chose to do the latter, to follow the lead of pop culture. The leader to blaze the trail, to adopt the pop cultural forms into the church, was a man named Charles Finney. Finney believed that conversion could be produced by human means, and so it was our job to bring people to a moment of crisis, to an exciting experiential moment wherein they will accept the claims of Christianity. And so he decided, well, I need to create an exciting atmosphere, and what better way to create an exciting atmosphere than to use the passionate music of pop culture? And that's exactly what he did. Finney found pop culture as the perfect tool for creating those experiences because it was immediate, it stimulated excitement. I mean, Finney told his musicians, look to the advertisers of the day and let them teach you how to write music. Do you see a difference? It used to be the musical forms were nurtured in the church and filtered down. Now, it's look to them. See what they're doing. And let's copy them. It's a total flip of perspectives. And this is the church, for the most part, evangelicals, fundamentalists even, followed Finney's lead. Now, the pop music of his day was things like Beautiful Dreamer, da, 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 da. We hadn't hit the jazz age and the rock age yet, okay? But, so it's not evil music, it's not corrupt, but it's certainly not music that is fitting for worship, I would suggest. But Finney and others after him said, let's use that kind of music. And this is where you get many songs being written that copy that kind of Victorian sentimentalism, communicating values that are not fitting with the worship of God's people. For sake of time, I'll skip over some of this here, but let's see. Okay, so here we have Finney, and here's what happened. Okay, so for a while, Christians, churches, good evangelical gospel preaching churches continued to sing the hymnody that they had inherited, but once we get to Finney, we have this for the first time ever. We have the church breaking off in a new tradition. It's no longer following in this tradition of the Judeo-Christian church, or the Jews and then the church, Israel and then the church. It's now taking its cues from pop culture. As Finney said, look to the advertisers of the day. Write music that will sell the gospel. Write music that will energize people, give them excitement, bring them to a point of crisis and decision. Now, at certain points along the way, it's evangelicals, fundamentalists, basically the same thing here. At certain points along the way, certain people thought that lines were being crossed, especially when we get to jazz and then rock. Some people, namely fundamentalists, said, we ain't going that far. And rightly so. Thank the Lord that they did that. And so we really have, skip over this. Let's do this first. Instead of text-driven hymns, we now have hymns centered around a catchy text and a tune. Instead of modest hymns, we now have hymns whose purpose is to create energy and excitement. Instead of hymns that were distinct from pagan culture was now supplying the musical forms. Let's skip over some of this for sake of time, maybe. Okay, this is where I wanted to be. Okay, so here we are in the jazz age now, and this is where fundamentalists said, We're not going that far. And basically, we, fundamentalists, have, in many ways, and this is with things like some gospel songs and some of these Sunday school songs and things like that, which are basically written in the musical forms that were the pretty sanitized pop music of the turn of the century, the Stephen Foster ballads, Daisy, Daisy, Give Me Your Answer, Do It, and that sort of thing, and maintained that tradition. And the rest of evangelicalism went and are still going. Yes? Right. A lot of the... I'm not saying at all that there are no good gospel songs. There are. But many of the gospel songs are written in the musical forms of the pop music of the turn of the century, which is a difference from what had been done for many years. And so essentially, I don't know if I do this on the chart. Oh, yeah. Okay. I've got cool little animations here. So essentially, in evangelical, broadly speaking, evangelical fundamental churches, we have three streams. Some are still maintaining the tradition, not really cultivating anything new because we just don't live in an environment like that anymore, but are still singing and nurturing the hymns that have been sung for hundreds and hundreds of years. Most fundamentalists find themselves here, singing still some of this, but predominantly singing music that was based on the relatively benign pop music of the turn of the century. And most of evangelicalism is continuing to spiral, and they follow every new cue by pop culture that's possible. Okay. Finally, and then we'll take some questions for the last 30 seconds that we have. What do we do? What do we do with all this? What's the whole purpose of all this? Okay. Well, where does this leave us today? As God's people, as His church, trying to conserve biblical worship in the 21st century. Well, I'd like to conclude with a couple of suggestions as we consider our choice of hymns, our choice of worship, music, in the church today. Number one, we need to recognize the importance of form, which is what we talked about during the first session. Form shapes content. Music communicates, and we need to practice what we talked about this morning, especially and most narrowly when we talk about the music that we use in our congregational worship. What is this communicating? Not just is it joy, but what kind? Not just is it love, but what kind? And is this appropriate for the worship of God? Is this appropriate to express our hearts to the ruler of the universe? We need not only to be concerned that our hymns say the right thing, but we need to be concerned that our hymns say the right thing in the right way. That's important. Number two, we need to learn to distinguish between forms that nurture noble affection and forms that excite base passions. Excitement and enthusiasm are not what we're after in worship. We are after worship in spirit and truth. We understand the truths of Scripture, and that moves our hearts, and then we express what has been moved by truth through our hymns. The music doesn't somehow move us. We are moved by God. I think many worship music today is trying to do what the Holy Spirit is supposed to do. Trying to work people up into a condition of worship. And that may, depending on your tradition, that may be some kind of mystical trance, that may be some kind of rousing enthusiasm, or that might be some slap-happy southern good old time. And we think that's worship. And we use music that fits that. Folks, worship is not about excitement and enthusiasm. Rather, we should try to encounter the true and living God in the truths of His Word and then express right affection to Him through our hymns. That's our goal. And number three, we need to commit to cultivating the forms of the Judeo-Christian tradition. We can't simply decide that we're going to work harder at producing good hymns. We have to start somewhere with something. Nobody starts in a vacuum. And I believe that the best, wisest course of action is to start with the tradition that got it right and move from there. We need to recover what we've lost and then move forward. There's nothing wrong with writing and singing new things. There's nothing wrong with changing. There's nothing wrong with cultivating and nurturing new musical forms. As long as we've started with something that we know is good and then move forward. And I'm afraid a lot of well-meaning people are saying we need to write new good things that are doctrinally sound, but are working from within a tradition that is not fitting with that. Many in what's called the modern hymn movement. They're writing some very fine texts, but they are men who have been nurtured and grown up in pop culture, men who have written for the advertisement industry, and so they're naturally writing in those musical forms. It comes naturally to them. And those musical forms are not fitting with the wonderful truth that they are expressing in their texts. And then finally, we need to commit to passing this tradition to our children. I wish I could spend more time here. This is essential. Where my greatest hope lies is with our children. Our children's affections are still developing. And we have the weighty responsibility to shape them. We need to stop feeding our children trite Christian nursery rhymes. And we need to begin to nurture their sensibilities with the music of the Judeo-Christian tradition. We need to mold their malleable hearts from the earliest of ages to love the right way. I mean, even before our children are capable of believing the right things, they can learn to love the right way. They can learn to feel the right way. They can learn what reverent love feels like, what true worship feels like. This is why I bring my children into the worship service. I don't send them out to sing their own trite little things. I want them to learn worship from adults who know what they're doing. We need to pass this on to our children. They are our greatest hope, really. If we lose our children, I mean, think about it. People my age, I'm 30, who've grown up from the cradle to college singing trite, fluffy stuff that was designed to keep us interested in church. It's no wonder we want trite, fluffy stuff now to keep us interested in church. That's why we've got to teach our children what right worship sounds like, what right worship feels like, so that they, when they get to be 30, that's what they expect. When do we lose our children? We lose our children at the transition points between childhood and adolescence, or between adolescence and adulthood, because all of a sudden they've been singing goofy stuff all their lives, and then all of a sudden we expect them to sing hymns. Well, it's no wonder. It's our fault. Children can. My son's 3 years old. He knows about 25 hymns by heart, and he loves them. Children love what you give them. They do. They love what you give them, because that's the biggest objection I hear. Well, they just won't like it. They won't like church. Teach them what to like. All right, off of that hobby horse. A lot of material. Questions, comments. Anything. All right, can we pray together? Father, we've gone through a lot of information today, and I pray that it wasn't so overwhelming that we missed the important points that you would have to teach us today. Please help us to realize that our musical forms communicate something, and that's important that we distinguish and discern what they are communicating, especially for worship, but for all of life. Help us to determine to cultivating a tradition within our churches that maintains these characteristics of our songs being text-driven and modest and distinct from the pagan culture around us. Help us to not be pulled by the pop culture or the Christian pop culture. Help us to commit to worshiping you in spirit and in truth, desiring to encounter you in your word, to be moved by the truths of your word, and then to express our hearts to you through the hymns that we sing. Help us to learn from both the good and the bad of what has come before us, to not ignore history, but to learn from it, to learn what to do and what not to do. And help us, as we look to the future, to desire to cultivate the good that has come before us. Help us to be discerning people, not for our own sakes, not so that we can somehow feel better than others, but because we want to worship you rightly. Because we want to live holy lives that are untainted from sin. Because we want to see the gospel go forth. When people see us worship, we want them to see God was here. And so we ask that you would make us a people who are really discerning about these things. We pray this in the name of Christ. Amen.